Jim Rowan. This is September 20th, 1978, and he's in the process of running for mayor, but it's taken some time out to do this. To begin with, tell me where you came from and why you came to the university.
Well, I came from Washington, D.C. I was born in Washington, D.C. in 1945, moved to the Maryland suburbs in 1951, came to the University of Wisconsin primarily on the recommendation of my father and many of our family friends, some of whom had attended the University of Wisconsin, and all of whom were suggesting to me that it was an exciting place to go to school, a progressive university. I was anxious to go to school out of state. I took a trip around to half a dozen universities to which I had applied, but the University of Wisconsin was too far to reach by car, so we never came here, and I didn't like any of the other schools that I had applied to. So when I was accepted here, I decided to come, since I thought it couldn't be any worse than the schools I had seen.
And it turned out a lot better. You said you'd be glad to spend the summer sitting down on Union Terrace.
Oh, yes. It's turned out to be an excellent choice. And I decided after I finished school here to stay in Madison, and I've been here most of the period between 1963 and 1978.
I'll do that later. You told me your father had been a reporter for Newsweek.
Yeah, my dad was had been a reporter and later an editor at Newsweek, and in 1965 moved over to the Washington Post when the Washington Post purchased Newsweek magazine. And I was interested in writing. He had never encouraged me, however, to go to a journalism school. He had always felt that a broad liberal arts education was far more desirable for a writer than a journalism school program. And again, encouraged me to come here since it had a reputation for, its liberal arts college had a good reputation.
Is that why you majored in political science?
Well, I think I majored in political science because I thought it was somehow related to a study of government, and I was always interested in government. I really didn't have good reasons for majoring in political science. I accumulated more credits in English and went to graduate school in English.
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny, I don't even think of myself as having majored in political science. For some reason, always felt and still feel that I was spending more time in school studying literature than I was in my poli-sci classes.
Well, what were your politics when you came?
Well, when I came...
which was 1963.
Mm-hmm. When I came, I would have described myself as a liberal student. I had been involved... in civil rights activities in my high school, and felt that politically Madison and the university campus would be a good place to come because of its liberal reputation. I mean, I wasn't picking a school based on my politics, and I didn't really have real clear politics, but I would have described myself at the time as a liberal, and my parents had always voted Democratic, and I had worked in the presidential campaign of President Kennedy.
Oh, so you've been quite active.
Yeah, when I was 14, my older sister, who was 16, and I founded a Kennedy for President club, and went out and raised some money, and worked very closely with the Democrats in our neighborhood. So I guess I have political involvement that goes fairly far back, yeah.
You're one of those many people came and were really quite converted here. That is, they start off even as Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Were you, well, then you wouldn't have been particularly influenced by any of the faculty members that, to change your views. For instance, Bill Williams seems to have influenced.
Well, he was a very strong influence on me, even though I only took one of his courses, because he, I guess, I wasn't familiar with the term at the time, but I would suppose that he is a revisionist historian, and I wasn't at all familiar with very much history of American foreign policy, and I had really no political analysis of America's role in the world, and was only vaguely aware of American intervention in places like Latin America, Southeast Asia. And it was Williams, whose course I took in 1965, who really began to open up a whole different way of thinking to me. I was very impressed with his course, and it's funny, I still go back and look at my notes from his course and from some of Harvey Goldberg's courses. Goldberg's courses I was never enrolled in, but I used to sit in on most of his lectures. You see, you get compartmentalized here, even in the liberal arts college. I was taking political science courses, English, because I was interested in it, and then there was a science or language component that you had to take, mm-hmm. and I only took a couple of history courses for credit, one of which was Williams and one of which was one of George Mossy's courses. But by the time I was graduating, and during the time I was a graduate student, I spent a lot of time sitting in on history courses, and I was sorry that I hadn't taken them, and I was probably sorry that I hadn't been a history major too. But I think that I think that what was happening in the 60s was something that happened to me and happened to other students too, which was there were events going on which were forcing you to think things through, and there were professors on campus whose courses and whose lectures helped you to sift through what was happening and trying to come up with some kind of analysis. And so I think some professors did influence me in that way. Mm-hmm.
And were any of the political science professors of any particular interest?
Well, let's see. The tape will show a long blank space here. A lot of the political science courses I took were just really very traditional studies of government and sort of spheres of power and spheres of influence analyses, sort of almost apolitical. Now, I did write a thesis as an undergraduate as a way of getting 6 credits, and I wrote the thesis under a professor from whom I also took a couple of courses, so I think I must have generated almost half of my credits from one professor whose name was Dolbear,
mm-hmm.
Ken Dolbear, who was a pretty strong influence on me and my roommates. We were all taking his courses together. And I think what we were mostly impressed with about him was not necessarily his political analysis, but it was his brilliance. He was an extremely bright guy, and he was just an interesting person to talk to about a number of things. But I never had the sense, I mean, he was a Republican, and he sort of used to work in campaigns for Republicans here. I can remember he was very involved in Bill Smith's campaign for Congress against Kastenmeier, right at the height of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't, for the life of us, understand why Dolbear would be working for Bill Smith. And we asked him one day, and he said something about Kastenmeier being a lazy, not lazy, he didn't say lazy, but sort of a safe seat Democrat. Excuse me. So we weren't really impressed with his politics. Now, his politics have changed a lot, and I have been in touch with him briefly in the last few years, and other friends of mine have been, and now he's a different kind of person. So I guess I would have to say that Dolbear was an influence. He was a he was an influence in the sense that you would try and be like him, you'd try and emulate him.
Mm.
We weren't necessarily enraptured by his political stance, though.
Well, you said you had participated in student demonstrations and sit-ins and that sort of thing, but you didn't get involved in any sort of organization until
67 was were the years that I was involved in the draft resistance union.
As a senior, then you would have
been. Yeah, as a senior. No, I really wasn't involved in organizations. I was just sort of a typical student. I was, you know, I had my classes to go to. I had a girlfriend.
Was that Susan?
That was Susan. I spent time with my friends, and I wasn't living in a dormitory. I was sort of an independent student.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until the sit-ins at the administration building in 1965 that I began to meet people who were involved in organizations. And it was at that point that I began to see that if you really were serious about political activity, you had to do more than just, you know, show up when somebody else called a demonstration. You should be part of the process for getting the demonstration off the ground. I had been involved in, there were civil rights demonstrations here in the early 60s that I was involved in too, but yet I never went one step farther. And you know, I would go to demonstrations that Friends of SNCC would call,
mm-hmm.
but I never went to a Friends of SNCC meeting. So it wasn't until later that I began to go to meetings of one kind or another.
What do you think made you, because that's quite a step.
Well, the Draft Resistance Union was, of course, a group that was organized to counsel people about the draft and to organize direct opposition to the draft. And it seemed to me to make sense that an organization could actually accomplish certain things as far as draft resistance that an individual couldn't. And I think a lot of us in the same position were beginning to get some degree of political enlightenment, which was you could do certain things on your own, but you had a better chance if you did them together with other people, and it's the basic theory of organizing. And I think it began to, it wasn't just, you know, I didn't have a little revelation one day that I had to work in an organization. It just sort of became clear that organizations could get you certain things that you couldn't do as an individual. And I don't remember exactly why I went to a draft resistance union meeting. I remember the roommates that I had at the time had a friend named Dan Swinney, who was one of the major draft resistance organizers in town. And I met him, and I guess I went to some parties with him, and just sort of began to get interested in draft resistance as an activity. So I suppose the influence of friends is important, too.
And I suppose you felt pretty strongly about the war, too.
Well, I was, I think that I could say that I was, I can remember having an argument in the Memorial Union with a friend of mine who was a freshman in September of 1963, because we'd only been at school a couple of weeks. We both came from Washington, and we were still sort of checking out the union.
Mm-hmm.
We were sitting at a table in the union, and we were waiting for another friend who was from Washington. We were all sort of sticking together because we were sort of a little overwhelmed by being here and didn't know people. And while we were waiting for this other friend to come to the union, somebody had left the New York Times on the table, and I was reading about a little article about President Kennedy sending some advisors to South Vietnam. And I remember saying to this friend of mine, something to the effect that I thought that was ridiculous. I mean, why would President Kennedy, this guy that we had worked for, you see, why would President Kennedy be sending American troops to some country that I'd never even heard of? It. I don't think I even knew where it was. And this friend of mine said, well, you know, something to the effect that if the Americans are doing something somewhere in the world, it must be good. And I said I thought that was crazy and that I didn't see why we would be sending troops overseas. Nobody declared war. And I've always thought that I could date my opposition to the war in Vietnam back to 1963.
That's very handy. Puts you very early in it.
Very
too.
Early. Very early. So I was always opposed to the Vietnam War that I can recall. I never had any equivocation of feeling about whether we ought to be there or not. Now, as time progressed, I think I had more and more justification for being opposed to the war in Vietnam. And at some point, it became a very personal thing, as it did to everybody who was threatened with either being drafted or having a child drafted or a brother or a friend drafted. So as I began to become more and more threatened, then I suppose my opposition to the war became less theoretical and more personally pragmatic too.
Mm-hmm. So
what was the question?
Well, we were talking about you doing the Wisconsin draft.
I had reached this decision quite early that if I was ever drafted, I wouldn't go. And the Draft Resistance Union began to organize a public statement around that principle, which came to be known as the We Won't Go Statement, which was a full-page ad taken out in the Daily Cardinal by a group of us in 1967, if I'm not mistaken, stating that if drafted, we would not go and we would urge others not to go. And we had a long, long series of really emotional debates about whether to do this or not. We were all very scared. We were counseling other people about the draft, but we really didn't know what our own liabilities were. We didn't know whether we could be arrested for that kind of a statement, whether we would be investigated, what the effect would be on our futures, our jobs, our graduate school. It was a great unknown step to take, and you know, we thought it was a pretty big deal at the time, and we were all very worried. And we decided to do it anyway, and it caused a great uproar in the city and among younger people. And it got the Draft Resistance Union a great deal of publicity. And it's interesting that now it's considered one of the acid tests of your political purity by people who are still around here, if you were here at the time, whether you signed the We Won't Go statement. And I have one friend who, every time we get on this subject, just starts bitterly talking about how nobody told him the statement was being written and he didn't get his name on it. And he's very upset about that. My wife's name is on that statement too, because, I think it was a mark of the progress of this group of people that it shows that the seeds of the women's movement were already around, or that people on the left tended to be a little more progressive on this whole question of women's rights and equality, because it was never debated whether women should be excluded from signing the statement since they weren't eligible for the draft. It was a statement of principle, mm-hmm. and a statement of support, as well as a statement by the men. So, but there was never any talk, for instance, of having a separate women's auxiliary group or a statement of support by the women for the men. It was just seen as a statement that men and women could sign. So her name is on there, and a few others.
How many of you were there, to begin with? I suppose it grew rapidly.
I think there were about 70 signatures.
Because they weren't all members.
I think the Draft Resistance Union I don't know, it really didn't have members, but the people who would come with regularity to meetings and would do the work and do the leafleting and all of that was probably about 15 to 20 people. Mm-hmm. It was very small.
Where did you meet?
Well, we met at people's houses, and then the Draft Resistance Union had a headquarters. Now, where was it? Somewhere in the what we would used to call Mifflin. It's now the Bassett neighborhood. To change the name of the neighborhood. For some reason, it seems to me that it was on West Gorham Street, near where the old co-op was, or on Hamilton Street. Maybe on Hamilton Street. My memory is vague on that.
But not at the university, because a lot of these groups seem to have met at the union.
No, this was definitely off campus. This was off campus. And I think that some of the organizers weren't students anymore. They had dropped out of school to do organizing, which was very common at the time.
Mm-hmm.
My wife dropped out of graduate school and gave up a Vilas fellowship to be a full-time political person. This now causes her some regrets.
When? What year did she do that?
1970.
Oh.
She was a history graduate student and never in her years in graduate school received anything less than a 4-point, but was so committed to anti-war organizing that she felt she couldn't do that and be in school at the same time, and something had to go, so it was graduate school. People gave up a lot at that time. Mm. So it wasn't uncommon for people to drop out of school and do organizing.
Hank Haslack was one of the draft resistors.
Yeah, he was. I really didn't know him then. I knew who he was, but I didn't know him. And I didn't really become aware of Hank Haslack until the Dow demonstration.
So he wasn't prominent in this early organizing?
He may have been, but I just might not have noticed him. The person that I related to was a man named Dan Swinney.
Mm-hmm.
Who,
I haven't encountered his name at all.
Oh, I think Dan was probably the organizer, the sort of Mr. Draft Resistance in town. Sort of he was always sort of an enigmatic figure. I don't think he was in school, or if he was about to drop out, and sort of very courageous. And his girlfriend shot him a couple years later, and nearly killed him in some sort of domestic argument. And she's still around town. Her name is Gwen Gillen, I think. Yeah. And she has a kid at the Red Caboose now. I see her picking up her kid at the same daycare center where my kids are. And I always look at her just a little askance.
Well, the reason I ask about Hank Haslack is that I wondered about the tie between the draft resistors and SDS at that time.
I couldn't tell you much about that, because SDS was something that was going on, but I wasn't involved in it. I was aware of it. But like I said, I wasn't involved in organizations. SDS I didn't get involved in until 1969. And I forget what happened. Something happened somewhere in 1968. Now wait a minute, I'm confusing my dates. My wife and I were gone from Madison between the summer of 1968 and the winter of, let's see, now just a minute, I am really confused here. No, we were gone from the summer of, from June 1968 to December of 1968. I had graduated from graduate school. I mean, I had my master's degree. We had gone.
So you got your master's in a year then?
No, 2 years. No,
three,
this is
four, seven.
No, wait, no, wait. I went to graduate school from 67 to 68 and finished my coursework.
Mm.
We both left in 68. We went to South Dakota to work in her father's Senate re-election. Left South Dakota in November and came back to Madison in December. Susan enrolled in graduate school, and I went to work at the Cardinal, and I started studying for my master's examination on my own, mm-hmm. without going, because I didn't have any classes left to do. And that was between December 68 and the summer of 69, and I took my master's comprehensives, I think, in August of 69, or July of 69. So there was a little period there when we were gone. When we came back in 1968, we got involved again in campus politics, and some, like I said, there was something going on. And Susan and I were sitting around talking about it, and she said, you know, SDS is really the only group on campus that's doing anything about it. It must have had something to do with the war. And she said, you know, if we really want to feel like we're involved in what's going on campus, we probably ought to go to SDS. And quite honestly, I can remember being a little uptight about that, because SDS had this reputation for being very heavy. And
well, this was after 60, after the...
this was after the convention.
Yes.
Yeah. And I didn't know anything about SDS here. And I was a little nervous about doing that, but we went anyway. And we found out that, in fact, Madison SDS was an independent chapter. It was one of the biggest chapters in the country. It wasn't affiliated with one of the two national SDS factions.
Yeah, there's an article about that in the Cardinal.
And the two SDS factions were always sending people to Madison to try and convince the group to affiliate with one or the other. But Madison always was independent and always made sure to call itself Madison SDS instead of just the SDS chapter on campus, because it probably didn't make any difference to 99% of the people who knew or heard anything about SDS, but we wanted to make it clear that we were not affiliated with and didn't endorse what the two factions were doing, particularly to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some event that pushed us into SDS, but I don't remember what it was.
Some political event.
Some political event, something obviously related to the war in Vietnam, but I, like I said, I can't remember what it was. So that's how we got involved in SDS. Then, yes, Hank Haslack was an SDS.
Except he dropped out in 68.
Okay. The people that I knew in SDS were Bill Kaplan. I don't know if you've talked to him.
Mm-mm.
No, you really should. He and his twin brother, Michael, were really...
That's
leaders.
Right. Wasn't one of them on WSA? Or
yes.
Head of it?
A student mm-hmm. senator. The Kaplan brothers and a fellow named Alan Hunter, who was a history grad student, and who got booted out of the university in February or March of 1970 because a police informer claimed that he helped turn over a police car on campus. In fact, he didn't. But he was the president of SDS, and the university wanted to get him, so they got him. And this is a digression, but this, for many of us, was our first encounter with police undercover informants. And the man is a detective on the police force now. His name is George Kroll. I just saw him this morning directing traffic. And George Kroll got up at a trial and said that he saw Alan Hunter turning this car over and pounding on it and yelling for others to come turn it over. And that wasn't true, because during the demonstration, Alan Hunter and his girlfriend Lisa, to whom he's now married, and my wife and Stephen Reiner, who was the editor of the Daily Cardinal, were standing about 50 yards to the west of where this little thing was going on, just sort of watching and saying, you know, these people are going to get in trouble. And then a couple days later, we found out that Alan had been arrested for organizing or for leading this thing. And it wasn't true.
Well, couldn't you do anything about it?
Well, Steve Reiner testified in court. I couldn't testify in court because I had also been arrested for allegedly throwing a rock at the Army Math Center at the same demonstration.
Oh, and was this the demonstration against the Army Math Center?
This was
there were several of them.
It was a demonstration against the presence of General Electric recruiters on campus, which then went over to the Army Math Center. But anyway, it was felt that I wouldn't be a credible witness since I was arrested too. And we were all dumbfounded. There were, I think, 6 or 7 people who got up and testified that they had been with Alan Hunter. Alan Hunter didn't touch the car. Alan Hunter got up and didn't touch the car. And the judge, I believe it was either Bensley or Bardwell, just simply found him guilty. And it was our first encounter with just how powerful police witnesses were. It didn't matter if they weren't telling the truth, and it didn't matter if the whole raft of witnesses were present to give an opposing story. We simply weren't going to be believed. We had no credibility. So anyway, it was Alan Hunter, the Kaplans, who were influential in STS. David Siff, a university professor, whom you should interview.
Where is he?
He's in New York City now. It's too bad.
We better stop.
I was relating that David Siff was another important person in STS. David was an English professor, very popular on campus, very radical. His grandfather had been one of Trotsky's tutors, when the family name was Ziv instead of Siff. And he and his wife Jenny and their kids Ivan and Ellen were probably our best friends in 1969 and 1970. And David was run out of the English department in the Purge.
Did they know he was on SDS?
David was very.
He didn't attempt to hide it.
He was very public about everything he did, and probably the thing that gained him the most notoriety was. David and I and 2 mathematics graduate students wrote a pamphlet for SDS called The Case Against Army Math. And then I wrote another one called The Case Against ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was working in SDS, I tended to be one of the writers and a sort of propagandist. And so David was well known on campus for that. And his presence in SDS really infuriated the university.
I'm sure it did.
I mean, they couldn't control what these, you know, kids were doing, and they could always dismiss them as immature and anti-intellectual and crazy and drug-crazed or whatever else. I mean, Chancellor Young could get away with publicly calling me a bum, but he couldn't do that to David Siff because David had a PhD and was a professor and had a whole cloak of legitimacy that students didn't have. And so they really wanted him out, and they got David and the other people in the English department. So David, who had been an actor before he was a teacher, he was a little older than the rest of us. I mean, David is, I think, now 42 or 41. David then left after a while and with his family went to New York and started teaching again, but he also got back into acting and is now a professional actor in film and television. So you should interview David.
That's fascinating.
He is really a genuinely nice person and a completely non-threatening person. And the fact that the university didn't want him to teach here was a real tragedy.
What was his field?
His field was literature. I don't remember what he was teaching. I should be able to remember that.
Well,
you see, it's funny, when I would talk to David, we'd never talk about his profession. We'd talk about his politics.
Mm-hmm.
I think he taught sort of, I would guess he taught a sort of contemporary survey course, freshman English too.
Mm-hmm. You didn't take, well, you wouldn't have taken any courses from him.
No, I never did. I didn't get to know him until I was a grad student, and then I was taking the usual range of boring courses as a grad student. Milton, Chaucer, pre-Shakespearean drama, all of which I like, really, I do, but I, at the time, it was certainly not as interesting as reading an economic analysis of the labor movement or something like that.
And your thesis was on Melville, you said?
Well, I didn't write a thesis, but he was the person that I specialized in and took my seminars in, probably retained more about than the other authors that I read. So we were talking about who was in SDS, and I was just mentioning David Sipp. Let's see, who else was in SDS? SDS, by the very end of the 60s, had a regular core of about 200 people. It was fairly substantial. Anytime that SDS had a meeting, it was a good-sized meeting. It would fill a big classroom.
Mostly students?
Nearly all students. Nearly all students.
Fill a big classroom. So they did meet on
SDS campus. Met on campus. It met at the Union, and it met on campus. It would meet in B-10 or B-130 Van Vleck or 105 Psychology. And then there was what developed in towards the end of the time that I was here, say from the end of 69 to May of 70, and then I left Madison again, was the evolution of a group called Mother Jones, or the full name was the Mother Jones Revolutionary League. Originally it was going to be called Volunteers Volunteers of America, until we found out that that was the name of the Salvation Army's group, so we didn't want the same name. Somebody picked Mother Jones because Mother Jones was a woman and she was a labor leader and a radical. And Mother Jones was designed to be an underground group, which was another so-called big step in the movement. And there's all kinds
of... Before you get...
Yeah.
Was it a split off from the SDS? Or?
Well, it was not so much a split as it was a recognition that SDS had informers in it, it had provocateurs in it, people who were really bent on causing trouble.
Not just police under underground agents, you mean? But.
Well, I think that they were either working for one police agency or another, or we ended up attracting some real crazies. Who wouldn't be disciplined at all about what we were doing and would go off and start some trouble and then the whole thing would disintegrate. So it was a recognition that if we were going to do some serious political work, although we never did any that I can recall, we would have to be a much tighter group, and it would mean a certain level of secrecy. And I was in Mother Jones for just a couple of months, because I didn't like that. It just, you know, people were talking about doing security checks on other people, and there was such an atmosphere of paranoia. Meetings were held in people's homes, and you would never know where the meeting was until the steering committee called the meeting, and then you would have to go to a certain street corner, and somebody from the steering committee would come up and say that the meeting is at such and such a house, and this was a way to be absolutely security conscious, and it was sort of craziness. In fact, that's one reason why I left Madison and my wife wanted to leave Madison, was that things had gotten so far, I would say, out of hand, out of perspective, that it was just hard to function here if you were a serious radical.
Gee, this is... Well, let me go back to
I know, I got way ahead of the game.
There's a little article in the Cardinal about there being a split between SDS and the Draft Resisters Union, of which I have the date somewhere here, 1668 perhaps. I wondered about that. I wondered if you were there, if you knew anything about it.
No, I don't. I mean, I sort of was in the Draft Resistance Union and then drifted out of it when I left here after the end of the spring semester in 1968. And when I came back here in December of 68, I was no longer involved in draft resistance. I was in SDS, and then I'd gone to work for the Cardinal, you see. And I hadn't gotten involved in this big personal research project, which I ended up printing in the Cardinal, so I didn't have time for draft resistance.
I wondered if that represented some different, I suppose in tactics it would have been that maybe
probably.
But then you say you helped organize Mother Jones.
Yes.
But then people in it had policies that you didn't agree with, finally.
Well, yeah. The
was
theory.
Susan in it too?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The theory about Mother Jones was that, it sounds so crazy now, it was our analysis that there was a vacuum in leadership on campus, that there was no single group recognized as leadership. And leadership was a group that would call demonstrations, organize strategy against the war and against university complicity with the war. We felt that the only way we could ever assume leadership was to present to the anti-war movement a group that was very coherent, very clear, very serious, really had it together. And that we couldn't do that kind of planning at public meetings because the informers were there. And we plan a demonstration, we'd go out to have the demonstration, and lo and behold, the police would be waiting for us because they knew exactly what the plan was. We went about setting up this sort of like a second level of SDS. People that were in Mother Jones were all in SDS, but it was clear that if you were in Mother Jones, that was confidential, and nothing was to be discussed about Mother Jones
in SDS meetings.
In anywhere outside of Mother Jones meetings.
So SDS people didn't know that you were members of Mother Jones?
Probably not. And then what would happen would be Mother Jones would call these demonstrations, let us say, but nobody would know who Mother Jones was except it would be somehow understood that Mother Jones had come out of SDS.
Mm-hmm.
But because, let's say, a demonstration would disintegrate into violence and there was property damage, if Mother Jones had called the demonstration, Mother Jones's leadership might be held accountable somehow. And there was always the fear of conspiracy charges. So the leadership of Mother Jones was to be kept completely confidential, as was the membership. So I forget the date, I think it was in February or March of 1970. I think it was in February. Mother Jones planned its first, well no, it didn't plan a demonstration. What was happening was there was going to be a big rally at night, and there was going to be a big march, and our plan was to take control of the meeting, take control of the rally and take it a specific place and make it clear somehow during that process that this was Mother Jones. Mother Jones was surfacing. Mother Jones was doing its first public thing, and we were going to do it well organized, and whatever it was we were going to do, it would be done well, and everybody would be impressed at this new leadership cadre. And so we had this plan that the march was going to go up University Avenue to Charter Street and stop. And the demonstration was going to be going one way and we were going to take it somewhere else. And at the critical moment, and this was a huge demonstration, at the critical moment where Mother Jones was supposed to, people from Mother Jones were supposed to sort of get up at the front and say, we're taking it somewhere else. The two of the people on the steering committee were going together, a man and a woman. And they had this argument
about tactics. And it was like vaudeville. It was, now that I look back on it, it must have been hysterically funny. Here was this man and woman having this tremendous fight in the middle of this demonstration, with all the rest of us sort of standing around thinking, my God, this is just awful. Having this argument about which route to take. And finally, the man, and I'm purposely not using names because I'm still held to my pledge of confidentiality, except for myself, my own name. The man finally told her just to shut up because he was a man and she was a woman and she didn't know anything about tactics. And the whole thing just sort of fell apart. And then the police showed up. And the police by that time were operating what they called affinity squads, which were little groups of plainclothes policemen with blackjacks. And they just went through the crowd breaking heads. And that was a terrifying tactic they used, because you didn't know if the guy standing next to you who was wearing a lumberjacket shirt and a ski mask was a friend or a guy who was about ready to knock you unconscious. And that process started, and there was some rock throwing on University Avenue, and that was it. And meeting after Mother Jones had this meeting to engage in what's called criticism and self-criticism. And the self-criticism was very severe. And I was completely disillusioned. My wife was so disillusioned she didn't go to the meeting. And I was so disillusioned that I just said that this group was a farce and I was leaving.
Now you're disillusioned because of this breakdown of decision making.
Well, it was that, and it was clear that we were sort of trying to do something that was totally impractical. I mean, you sort of look at the internal contradiction of trying to have a secret group doing something publicly. It just wasn't going to work out. There was too much paranoia about being a member of this little secret society. And I just walked away from it. And I never really, it was amazing that most of my friends were in Mother Jones. And I never knew what they did after that. I never asked, they would never volunteer information.
Were they close friends?
Yeah.
I mean, did you see them in other ways?
I did, but see, this was in February, and by May...
Oh, so there wasn't much time.
We were gone, yeah. So a brief flirtation with an underground group that never did anything except sort of inadvertent street theater.
Were your articles on ROTC and MRC, I mean, the brief ones?
Yeah.
But the three demands, was that a Mother Jones?
No, the three demands was SDS.
Mm.
Or that was SDS.
Did you approve of that, the Mother Jones people?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah. See, the three demands was the beginning of SDS trying to take the anti-war movement to a different political level on the basis of an anti-imperialist political analysis. That the war in Vietnam was not an aberration, but was in fact part of an anti-communist worldwide political strategy, economic strategy on the part of the United States that required bases overseas and protection of markets, and that the United States had chosen to make its major stand against communism in Southeast Asia, and that we, SDS, wanted the University of Wisconsin not to be involved with that process. So the three demands were organized around the Army Math Center, the Land Tenure Center, and ROTC, mm-hmm. each being related in some way to American foreign policy.
So Mother Jones was more how you did things and when and where than policy.
Right.
The policy was the same policy as SDS.
I would agree with that, yeah. Yeah. Mother Jones was a procedural vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
It was supposed to be action oriented.
Inevitable word.
These were crazy days. They really were.
But you didn't. I should think you would have welcomed having police in the crowd who with blackjacks, because then that would show that there was real enmity. give you an excuse for having a demonstration, in a way.
Well, I never believed in that. There were a lot of people who said what you got to do is really go out and provoke the police, because then the police will do their thing, and that will radicalize people.
Yeah.
But I never liked that, because first, people always got hurt that way. And secondly, whatever issue it was that you were trying to demonstrate against would always get pushed into a secondary position behind the issue of police brutality. That's what happened at Dow.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened every other time it was police brutality. People would, of course, be outraged by police brutality, and they'd spend all their time talking about whether or not the police ought to be on campus and whether police ought to carry weapons and why do police do what they do and was there really police brutality? Who started it? Did the students start it? Did the police start it? Were the police really violent? Were people just resisting arrest? You know, and it always sort of devolved into this argument about police brutality. And
but you didn't think that helped the cause? That
well, it may have, but in fact, I mean, I know that it did. I mean, you know, I would trace a lot of my own radicalization to the Dow demonstration and to being personally beaten by the police. But as an organizing tactic, it's very manipulative to set up a situation where some innocent people are going to get hurt. And I never liked that. Never believed. I mean, on a grander scale, there are people who will tell you that you aren't going to ever have any social change in the United States that is progressive and systemic or whatever until you go through a period of real fascism, and that's what it will take to educate enough people to go out and change things. And I always thought that was preposterous.
I guess I would imagine a good many people thought that that's what SDS wanted, was to provoke brutality in order to arouse people. But this isn't necessarily true.
No, I don't.
Some of them did.
I suppose some people did. It was when we were in SDS, we never discussed that as a motivation. It may have been some people's personal little agendas. And I think that, you know, you had a certain set of assumptions about a demonstration. That the demonstration would be called and there'd be a lot of publicity and then there'd be this tremendous tension in a demonstration. There's a great deal of tension. People are all keyed up and the cops were always keyed up. And it didn't take much to provoke a policeman in those days. You know, all you had to do was look at them in a strange way and call somebody a name. They're much smarter now. They don't react. But in those days, you know, you could curse at a police officer and he would likely knock you down or push you down. And then there were always people who were willing to go and fight with the police. And then half a dozen policemen would come to the aid of the one policeman who was in the initial fight, and then it would just sort of go from there. So it wasn't as if you had to have a strategy to provoke a police response. It always happened. Rarely did it not happen, let's put it that way.
I'd like to just have you answer briefly. Did you think that the people who had often organized the TAA mm-hmm. and got involved in that were sidestepping the main issue? Did you disagree with them? Were you against the TAA?
No. I thought that the TAA, some of the people organizing the TAA were trying to sort of impose a belief in unions and unionism and union organizing in a situation where it didn't really fit. But that was because I wasn't familiar with unions very much at all, and the unions that I knew about, you know, were blue collar, you know, factory production line workers, and I just didn't have a good concept of white collar unions or public employee unions, which I think I do now. So I can remember thinking at the time, you know, that the TAA was sort of that those people were going to have a lot of problems trying to organize teaching assistants, because in my own mind, they didn't fit into a mental picture of what workers looked like. But that was my own ignorance more than anything else.
But you didn't mind the fact that they had turned their attention from the anti-war movement?
Oh, no, because there were many people who had a limited amount of time, and there were some students who were organizing in their departments. There was the History Students Association, and there was a Comp Lit organization that was one in the genetics department, sociology. And there were some kids who spent a tremendous amount of time just trying to organize students and faculty in their own department. And that was sort of a narrow thing to do, but it made a contribution to a larger effort.
Contribution to the?
To the whole anti-war movement.
But then was that diverted into contribution to the TAA effort, or did you think they met each other?
No, you see, the TAA happened at the time that the Mifflin Co-op was happening, that Connections newspaper, later called Kaleidoscope, later called Takeover, was happening. It was the same time that the Daily Cardinal was undergoing changes, the WSA Pharmacy was getting off the ground, there were some housing co-ops starting, there was the women's movement starting. There was this really tremendous explosion of new alternative groups or things or institutions going on, and people on the left took their political analysis and applied it to their own situation. And see, the war in Vietnam just was a catalyst for so many things, and these things came out of the anti-war movement. The anti-war movement turned out to be directed as much against American society and traditional values here. I mean, there were supposedly was a sexual revolution going on at the time, which is debatable. But there were people who were very concerned about that and nothing else. There was a whole campaign on to educate people about homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
There was a whole smash monogamy movement, if you can believe that. I can tell you it was very difficult to be married and be a radical in that period. You were under tremendous pressure from your friends not to be married, certainly not to get married. And if you were married, I mean, people just looked at you like you were some sort of a relic.
That's interesting.
Because you had adopted an old way of thinking and an old way of acting and an old way of relating to people, an old way of organizing your life. And this was a new period. Everything was different. Everything was open to question. And whatever it was that was established, the alternative was considered to be better. For example, homosexuality was considered to be better than heterosexuality, or a more honest way of living, because you had somehow transcended the male-female dichotomy or role. And if you couldn't do that, then you certainly weren't monogamous, because monogamy was an old way of doing things. So anything that was an alternative to the status quo was considered more desirable. So people went out and formed labor unions and alternative newspapers and alternative stores, co-ops, alternative housing arrangements. And the TAA was a real visible example of people looking at the status quo and saying, okay, now we have to do something about that that's politically acceptable. And the answer is we need a union. And like I said, the only sort of difficulty I had with that was trying to figure out just how you could unionize teaching assistants.
You know, I was talking to a woman, Pat Russian, the other day, and she was telling me how the women's movement started, women's caucus started in TAA, and saying that the men were very sexist, and that her feeling was generally that the new left was very sexist, and they used the terms chicks and that sort of thing all the time. That the women really had to fight to get...
Well, that's very true.
Because you had said quite a while ago when you spoke about Susan signing the...
Yeah, I see I'm caught on a little contradiction here. Well, I guess both things are true. But you have to also remember that the left at that time was dominated by men, and because a lot of what the left was doing was sort of paramilitary or pseudo-military, and involved force and things like that. There was a lot of very aggressive behavior going on, that it tended to bring out a lot of real macho behavior in men. And I can remember when the Women's Caucus in SDS was founded, we were having a meeting at the Union in that part of the cafeteria that's sort of on the side. In fact, it's the same part where we mm-hmm. talked the first day. And there was a guy named Paul somebody, real hip guy, I don't remember what his last name was. Somebody had put on the agenda women or women's issues or something, and there was some discussion about it, and this guy Paul finally stood up and said, look, I thought we were here to discuss the war. When are we gonna stop talking about this women's business and get down to politics? And the women just exploded. They were saying that he didn't understand that this was a political question, too. And he was run out of SDS. It seems to me that Neil Koffler also made some kind of sexist remark and was literally beaten up by some women. I can remember Neil Koffler being beaten up by women at one of these meetings where he said the wrong thing. It's true, there was a great deal of if you look at SDS, the leadership with the Kaplan brothers, they were, you know, very, very, very macho. So it's a valid criticism. I don't know that the left was any more sexist than anybody else. We were probably more hypocritical. We thought.
Yeah,
we were.
I think that was the point.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
Stop here.